The British Superbike Championship is up for grabs this weekend in the Decider at Brands. But as you're about to hear, they've got quite the act to follow. Welcome to Bike Life. Let's go! Yes, welcome to episode 34 of Bike Life here on Motorsport 101. Looking ahead to this weekend as the Moto3 and BSB championships could well be decided. In the case of the British Superbikes, it will be decided. It is the Decider at Brands Hatch as the showdown comes to a head. Either Leon Haslam, Shane Byrne or Josh Brooks will walk away as the 2017 British Superbike champion. We'll also look ahead to this weekend's action at Motegi as the triple header of flyaways in MotoGP get underway, as the championships look set to be decided over in Asia. Moto3 is up for grabs this weekend as opportunity knocks for Joe and Mia. We'll also go over the big news as KTM finally confirmed their race riders for next season. Good news if you're a British fan. And we'll also tell you about all the big news from last weekend as titles were decided in Spain. Joining me this morning as we record this, it is just past 10 a.m. on Friday the 13th. Insert spooky jingle here. On a race weekend, or after a race weekend, where there was absolutely no racing of note to talk about, this is true commitment to the cause, Andre Harrison.
What's up, guys? We're doing some bike stuff today. I don't know what exactly, because there wasn't any actual bike racing this past weekend.
No.
Apart from all the free Speedway fans that are going to hunt me down for saying there was no Speedway this weekend when there was. But we managed to fish an idea out of our asses on this one. So enjoy this bonus episode.
Yeah. Bex is in Australia, so she's probably not going to hear this. So that's why we haven't really covered the Speedway. We'll mention it.
I see dark clouds forming in the distance.
They'll be rolling over Phillip Island in a week's time. We will cover the Speedway. We will mention it because it did take place last weekend in Torren, but we will get to that in the news, which will be around the halfway point in this show. Places you can find us before we actually get on with this week's show and tell you what we've got planned for it. Facebook.com/Motorsport101 if you want to follow us on there. We're on Twitter, and you might have strong opinions on the show that we're about to have. You might have your own views on what we've spoken about. Twitter at Motorsport_101. On YouTube, youtube.com/Motorsport101. Our website is motorsport101.net, where you can find back episodes of both of our shows. And if you like us so much that you want to back us financially, and you're not one of the plebs, shout out to the doctor on Twitter for that. Patreon.com/Motorsport101, where you will earn yourself early access to both this show and Motorsport 101, which this week hit episode 107. Given what happened at Suzuka, probably for the best that Dre wasn't a part of this one, because Ferrari's year-long quest to win the World Championship finally came to fruition. Only problem is, Dre, they won the championship for Mercedes.
Yay. I mean, I'm going to save most of my bits for the inevitable, much-requested video of me talking about this on the YouTube account this weekend. It'll probably be out by the time this show goes out. But to say the least, the fact that a car worth millions and millions of pounds was essentially ruined by a €59 spark plug, essentially gifting Mercedes both championships, safe to say I wasn't best pleased.
No.
Screw Ferrari and my mental health for basically teasing us for that for the last 16 rounds. I'm very grateful for this.
I have to say,
my full reaction to this weekend.
Yeah, I have to say, I hadn't set my alarm to watch it live because I had to go to work on Sunday morning, so it wasn't really a brilliant time to watch it. But I thought I'll get up about an hour before I have to leave for work, and I can sort of watch the race before I go, because I can sort of fast forward through the dull bits, which ended up being 95% of it. I woke up, checked Snapchat first, and saw two separate people on my story. I think you were one of them, basically saying, "Oh, for fuck's sake, Ferrari."
that was essentially me.
I was like, all right, back to bed. I was like, I think I know where this one's going. If you want to hear Dre's thoughts on that, probably, like I said, by the time you're listening to this, it will be on our YouTube channel, youtube.com/motorsport101. If you want to hear King and RJ's extended episode where they talk about that and all the other news of this week, episode 107 is up right now on all of the good places where podcasts are released. So go ahead and listen to that right now. For us, though, here on Bike Live, what we decided to do with this weekend, seeing the championship decider in the British Superbike Championship, and indeed a championship potentially being decided in Moto 3, we thought we'd go back down memory lanes. One of our favourite shows that the two of us have ever recorded was our show back in our Downforce run called MotoGP 250, where we went back through MotoGP's archives to look at some of the favourite races from the first 250. So we're continuing on that vein with this weekend, picking out our top 10 title deciders across the championships that we cover on this show. Now, understandably, if any of you are slightly older listeners and wondering why we haven't mentioned some from the 70s, give us a break. Neither of us were born then. But we have come up with a couple of notable mentions from the 90s, starting with Loris Capirossi and Tetsuya Harada in Argentina into the 250s in 1998, a move which got Loris Capirossi the sack from Aprilia. Even though he'd won them the championship, Capirossi essentially torpedoing Harada into the final corner. He did that. He obviously was watching Michael Schumacher at Jerez in Formula One a year prior. Essentially ran up the back of Harada into the final corner, knowing that, well, I don't think he necessarily knew this as he went for the overtake, but knowing that if neither of them finished, or if Harada didn't finish, Capirossi would win the title. Capirossi stayed on board, finished second in that race, and won the championship, but Aprilia decided to not offer him a contract for the following year, which meant Capirossi had to ride a Honda in 250s the following season, even though he was the reigning champion. Incidentally, that race in Argentina, 98 250s, was won by a young whippersnapper by the name of Valentino Rossi. Whatever happened to him? Incidentally, one other notable mention also comes from Argentina in the 125s a year later, where Azuma, Melandri and Altamora competed for the championships, and Emilio Altamora ending up winning it. Now, this is a guy who, to many of listeners who are slightly younger, will know Emilio Altamora as the manager of the Marquez brothers. But believe it or not, he was actually a former Grand Prix world champion of his own. And Altamora actually famous for being the guy that won the 125 championships in 1999 without winning a single race all year. Which is absolutely brilliant. Melandri didn't score a point for the first three races. He took the Keenan Sofwoglu route to championship success. Didn't score a point until round four, then went on a tear in the second half of the season. Azuma, who won pretty much everything in sight in the first half of the season, then took the Jenson Button Braun GP route to success and didn't win again. Altamora, by didn't have been successful in finishing second and third every other week, ended up winning the championship by 1 point. There were some interesting deciders back in the 1990s as well. But all of the 10 that we've identified and picked come from the 21st century, and we're going to start in 2015 at number 10 and head to Moto3, because of course there were two title deciders on that day in Valencia. You might guess that the other one that day is also featuring in our countdown as well. We'll get to that later on. But we're starting in Moto3, Dre, and the showdown between Danny Kent and Miguel Oliveira. And really, the way this season played out, particularly if you take this from sort of Sachsenring onwards, or even from Silverstone onwards back in August when Danny Kent won that rain-affected race, this was really a race or a season that had no right to even make it to a final round decider.
Indeed, yeah, absolutely right. I mean, Kent, I think, had something like a 70-80 point lead after that race at Silverstone, and then after that, Miguel Oliveira just pretty much just reeled him in with a string of ridiculous performances, where he was just untouchable the second half of that Moto 3 season, where he just had this tremendous level of racecraft where he was always in the same place, in the right place at the right time, and it worked out beautifully for him. He was so fast in the second half of that season. So that, alongside Kent being rather conservative and having a string of mediocre performances, pretty much opened the door for Miguel to have an outside chance of winning it going into the final round at Valencia.
Yeah, I mean, if either Messrs. Haslam, Byrne or Brooks are listening to this, this is not how you control a championship decider from Danny Kent. Because I guess one of the key moments from Danny Kent's point of view came on the last corner of Aragon, where he high-sided himself into oblivion when trying to finish. I think he tried to finish second in that race when third would have done. And I think it was really that moment, Dre, that kind of put the frighteners on him. Because I think it was that moment, that crash, which cost him a lot of points, which almost forced him into the sort of mindset of, I've got to be conservative here. I can't crash again. But in the end, he overdid it.
He did overdid it. Yeah, it was like, I think he was almost taken out by his teammate Hiroki Ono at the time, and I think that completely spooked him. It was like, you know what? I'm just going to stick around at the back of this pack. It's bound to be enough. Hmm. And it was only just barely enough for Kent to win the title. But boy, like I was watching that race live again. What the hell is he doing back there? Like Kent, go for the throat for God's sake! Like you're probably actually safer to just go for it and try and get up the field as opposed to hanging around at the back. Because if there's an incident where you could easily get collected in the back of that group, like don't like hanging around the back is not going to get you anywhere. And Miguel is probably going to be in the top two because he was pretty much ridiculous at that point in time. So, yeah, I mean, Ken, yeah, he did just enough to get over the line, but like you have to question what his thoughts were going into those last two or three rounds where it was just like, I'm just going to be completely conservative here and just, you know, have faith that Oliveira doesn't score enough points to chase me down in time. It's ridiculous. But
yeah, because Danny Ken went into this race needing only 2 points to win the championship. And this was having had 3 separate opportunities in Japan, Australia, and Malaysia to clinch the championship there and then and failed to do right. So. So it was his 4th and final chance to win it. And yeah, he was riding around in that race with his teammate Hiroki Ono, who was, understandably, given the way the race panned out, in his last race for Leopard. Because Ono started overtaking him during the race and racing his teammate. And we're thinking, Hiroki, what are you doing? This is your teammate's trying to win a championship here. And Danny Kent was just, I think, so frightened of getting involved in a race, he just stayed out of the group altogether and was riding around in 12th place, just cruising around, knowing that was enough to win the championship because he only had to be in the top 14. Because of course he'd already botched the qualifying that weekend, hadn't he? He had to start way back down the field and come through to 14th. And in the end, I think Danny Kent would probably tell us all that his approach was correct. And you can't really argue because he won the championship, but there was of course that ultimate pile-up at the final corner where 3 riders were taken out, including Danny Kent's teammate Efren Vasquez, where Danny Kent would probably turn around and say, well, hey, if I had got myself in the group, that could quite easily have been me skittled out at the final corner and that would have been the championship gone.
It's easy to justify now that he's actually won the title, but like if he turns out, if he doesn't win that title, what the hell would he be explaining to people then?
Yeah, because Miguel Oliveira went on a tear, winning 4 of the last 5 races to win the championship. And actually, if you stretch it back further, because obviously I mentioned that Silverstone race where Danny Kent won in wet conditions. From that point onwards, Danny Kent did not finish in the top 5 again all year. Miguel Oliveira had 4 wins and 2 seconds in the 6 races that remained and wiped out a near 100-point lead to only 6 points by the time the season finished in Valencia. But Danny Kent, with that 9th place in the end in Valencia, clinching the Moto3 world title in what has, to this point, Dre, I suppose, been the peak of Danny Kent's career.
Pretty much. It's not going any better for him since, but hey, he'll always have that Moto3 World Championship to hang his hat on.
Yeah, because of course he's going to be at Speed Up next season in Moto2, having, of course, that year turned down a potential MotoGP seat at the Pramac team to go up to Moto2 with his same Leopard team, and that worked out swimmingly for him, didn't it? To number 9 in our rundown, and yeah, this is one that also went swimmingly if you are from Yorkshire, because we're heading to Qatar in 2014 for the World Superbike title decider. To this day, the last World Superbike Championship to head to the final race. Of course, last year it went to Qatar, but was decided in race 1 of the weekend in favour of Jonathan Rea. This one went all the way to the wire, Dre, and this will probably go down in World Superbike history as the one where team orders overrid everything.
Yeah, pretty much.
On both sides.
Both sides, really. Yeah, like we had team orders on one side, and we had Loris Baz essentially rolling over for Tom Sykes, sort of, but begrudgingly, to a lesser degree at Magny Cours. We saw it at Magny Cours where, you know, Baz had parked his bike on the finish line, waiting for Tom Sykes to make a point. He was gonna, it was, okay, if I'm gonna listen to team orders, I'm gonna embarrass you while doing it, basically, which I can't really say I blame Bass for that, really. But, you know, at the same time, we had, at the front of the race, we had Marco Melandri and Magny Cours, who decided, I'm going to listen to team orders once. the Marco Melandri way of doing things. Not quite via the book, so to speak. In race one, he let Gintoldi through and let Gintoldi win. In race two, he won for himself because that's what Marco Melandri does. Nothing is straightforward with Marco Melandri.
And in many ways, this championship was it has similarities to the number 10 in our list, the Moto3 Valencia 2015. Because again, it was a sort of title decider that crept up on us because with three rounds of the season to go, after Laguna Seca, where Tom Sykes wins race two, I think we were all, because this was our very first season of Bike Live, and I think we were all pretty much of the opinion after Laguna that Sykes almost had it in the bag at that point.
You'd think. But yeah, Gintoldi had a very, very strong finish to the season on that Aprilia, and next thing you know, after you know, Spaz had to, you know, give up a couple of higher spots to give Sykes some points back, but like, the fact it had to go to team orders in the first place after Laguna Seca says a lot about how strong Ginter's finish was. And yeah, it forced Kawasaki's hands as we to try and protect the championship. It was awkward, to say the least.
Yeah, it was awkward, down to a pretty much irreconcilable breakdown in the relationship between Tom Sykes and Lawrence Baz at Kawasaki, which originated in Sepang that year, where Lawrence Baz took Tom Sykes out of the race down at the first corner in a race that was won in the end by Marco Melandri on the Aprilia ahead of Gintoldi. That was one of the races where Sykes lost a truckload of points to his then, well, didn't realise at the time was his title rival, but he would become his title rival later in the season. The two never really got on from that point onwards, Sykes and Baz, so as you'd understand, Baz wasn't really in a mood to help Tom Sykes later in the season. As Dre mentioned, he did so at Magny-Cours in race two of the weekend, sitting up and allowing Tom Sykes through to finish fourth in that second race of the weekend. But as I say, once they got to Qatar, he was not in the mood to do so. Southern Gintoldi winning race one with Baz beating Sykes to second in that race, which led to Tom Sykes eventually calling his teammate childish and unprofessional, which put paid to any hopes of Baz helping him out in race two.
Pretty much.
As it happened, and to be fair, this is one of the sort of, the, I think it's become a bit of a myth from that season that Lawrence Baz cost Tom Sykes the world championship. He didn't. Because, as it turns out, Tom Sykes could have still won the world championship with second in the final race behind Sylvain Gintoldi. As it was, he finished third behind Jonathan Rea, who was at that point still on a Honda. Because that was his last race for Honda before he joined Kawasaki to continue to ruin Tom Sykes' life at that team. Just as it was starting to go downhill for him in late 2014. But as much as the breakdown between Sykes and Baz kind of overshadowed it, the way that season ended up panning out, I think we have to, Dre, give due credit to your man Ginters, because he kind of discovered a level that I don't think any of us really thought he had until late 2014.
Indeed, I never would have thought Ginters would have had that in him, basically. I thought Melandri was going to be the guy that was going to be spearheading the charge for Aprilia that year. Turns out it was Ginters.
Yeah, just to go to Qatar with the championship on the line and pull out the weekend of his life to win the championship.
Pretty much. I didn't think that was possible, but no, he did the thing, and it was quality. Again, I would never have thought that he would have had that in him to do that, but that was Ginters for you. It was an incredibly impressive second half of the season run, and you know, props to Marco. He played his role in that too. You know, being a quote unquote professional about it, and you know, giving up at least a few points to help Ginters out in the long run. But yeah, it was all sorts of interesting things going on there, especially with Kawasaki.
Yeah, with Kawasaki, who wanted, yeah, in the end, Lawrence Baz would not ride for Kawasaki again, and to this point has not ridden for Kawasaki again in World Superbikes, because he then headed to MotoGP following that. Lawrence Baz has been linked in recent weeks with a move back to the World Superbike paddock for next year, but as you're going to hear later on when we get to the news, one of his likeliest sort of options for next year has now been taken up over at Red Bull Honda. So we'll tell you about that a little bit later on. But yeah, Lawrence Baz, I think in many ways, because he was the guy who, I'm trying to think of the right words to describe Lawrence Baz, because I certainly picked a few choice ones back then. He was very much the number two within his team at Kawasaki, and I don't think necessarily people thought Lawrence Baz had the level of riding in him that he has shown since then, because his reputation, not just in terms of his reputation as a team player, but his reputation as a world-class motorcycle rider who could compete at the highest level was in question around that time. But again, Lawrence Baz is a rider, Dre, who since that point has gone on to prove that he does belong with the very best in the world.
It's one of those things where, like, his MotoGP run, albeit brief, has proven that, you know, he is a quality rider, and he's had many outstanding performances in there, especially in changeable conditions, where, you know, he has proven to be a rider of enormous cojones. And yeah, it's a shame. It's a shame that, you know, Baz was kind of painted to be the villain in this instance, because, you know, he took Sykes out, and, you know, he was sometime-ish with team orders. But I mentioned being a Sebastian Vettel fan in the past. Like, you can't really dislike the concept of team orders and then dislike the guy who breaks them. You can't really have this both ways, unfortunately. Unfortunately, Baz tried to play both ends against the middle, and it turned out badly for him. And it turned out even worse for Tom Sykes, even though it didn't directly cost him a title. It wasn't a good look for Sykes, who basically had to rely on outside help to try and win him a championship. It was ugly for everyone involved in Kawasaki. We all saw the public Twitter spat again. But I have to thank Tom Sykes for being so petty about the situation, because if it wasn't for that, I wouldn't have gotten back into World Superbikes. Cheers, Tom.
Yeah, and you wouldn't have given us one of the most fiery episodes of Bike Life we ever recorded back in 2014, as Bex and the two of us went to war about it. But yeah, contrary to what you may believe from that year, it's funny how these sort of stories just become sort of mythical, in a sense, in that, you know, it's almost assumed that Baz screwed Sykes out of the world title back in 2014. Even if Sykes had been let through in race one in Qatar, he would have still had to finish second in the final race to win the championship, and he didn't. He finished third. So Gintoni ended up winning that title by 6 points in the end, and Sykes was only cost four, if you like, in that opening race in Qatar, where Stefan Gintoni won the world championship. Now, into number eight in our list, and this is also a World Superbike Championship decider. And another one, Dre, that kind of crept up on us, and a championship decider that wasn't really looking like one, even as early as race one of that weekend, because heading into the final round of 2012 at Magny-Cours, Max Biaggi virtually had the championship in his pocket, and then in the wet conditions at Magny-Cours, tried to find every conceivable way to lose it.
That's the wet race for you. You never quite know what's going to happen, do you? And, yeah, you thought Biaggi would have had it sewn up by this point. But it wasn't quite as simple as that, bless him. You know what wet races are like. They can be very unpredictable. And Max had all of a sudden left a very, very big door open for a certain Kawasaki rider after his race one retirement.
Yeah, because this season, 2012, was really where the what we now know as the Kawasaki dynasty, this was where it began, or where it started to begin, because Kawasaki, literally in 2011, took their first win becoming the factory team they are now, where Tom Sykes won a rain-affected race at the Nürburgring, which was stopped halfway through because it was absolutely pissing it down, and they called it early in many ways, similar to what BSB did at Silverstone a few weeks ago, and Sykes was declared the winner. Now, into 2012, Tom Sykes was not really a championship contender at any stage that year. He was sort of on the peripheral of it, as Biaggi and Marco Melandri battled for the title. And it was really Biaggi's sort of faffing about trying to clinch it late in the season. He only had one podium in the final five races of the year. Max Biaggi, he kind of limped his way to the title, and Tom Sykes suddenly started catching him and chasing him down. Marco Melandri also did not race in either race at Portimao because he was injured, which really cost him any hope of the championship. And Max Biaggi went into that final race weekend at Magny-Cours 30 and a half points clear. Remember that half, it becomes important later. 30 and a half points clear of Tom Sykes. And Tom Sykes would go on to make up 30 of those points in the two races at Magny-Cours, finishing third in race one as Biaggi, in the wet conditions, fell off and crashed, which meant that Tom Sykes needed to win the final race at Magny-Cours, and Biaggi had to finish in the top five to win the championship. And Biaggi just about called it spot on, finished in fifth position. Tom Sykes winning it, which was a surprise to many, because Tom Sykes wasn't really a wet weather rider. Oh, he's not really known as one now, but his early wins really came in wet conditions. He won that second race, and in the end, missed out on the championship by half a point. And in the end, it was the cancelled race, or the shortened race at Monza earlier that year, back when World Superbikes raced at Monza, if only they went back there, where the Pirelli tyres were falling apart in the mixed conditions. They called the race early and gave out half points. That was the race that Tom Sykes actually won. but was only given 12 and a half points for it. Which ultimately cost him the title that year. Max Biaggi was trying to sort of control it in Danny Kent fashion, I suppose, and made a pig's ear of it and ended up winning the championship by half a point that season. Proved Dre that in any championship, half points are just bad news.
Yeah, half points are terrible. They should be scrapped. They should be gotten rid of. Like, I don't know why they exist. It's terrible. But in all seriousness, it's one of those things where you like. I guess a championship feels like pity because it didn't run anything near a full race. So why give full points for it? I get that. I get the logic behind it, but it can have a catastrophic effect on a championship, and this was one of those occasions because Sykes only getting half points for his win at Monza, well, it cost him the championship, essentially. It's one of those things. It couldn't be helped on this one, and, you know, I wonder if Sykes is still mad about that one. Probably is.
To be honest, I don't think he's so much mad about that one. No, he's near half as mad as he is about 2014. But in terms of 2012, yeah, that race at Monza ended up being called after three laps.
Did you even bother running it at that point then?
Yeah,
seriously.
Pirelli's tyres, because it was a sort of drying track and they obviously didn't have an intermediate tyre back then. They only had the wets and the dries. And it was way too dry to run wet tyres. But when they tried to run the dry tyres, they weren't standing up to the long straights of Monza. I mean, incredibly, as amateurish as that sounds. So what they ended up doing in the end was calling it after three laps and saying, right, we're gonna hand out half points here and just be done with this. Because race one the day before had already been cancelled because it was too wet to run. In the end, we only got three laps of racing across the 2 days at Monza back in 2012, and I don't think World Superbikes has been there since. Not the greatest of memories for World Superbikes of Monza, although I do still wish that they would go back there, because I still remember the 2011 races where Eugene Laverty took his first couple of wins, and it was brilliant racing that day around Monza. But it's amazing how the calendar has changed from back then, back in 2012, because back that year they went to Monza, they went to Miller Motorsports Park in the United States. And raced on the Monday there because they raced on Memorial Day that weekend. So the races took place on the Monday rather than the Sunday. Yeah. Doing that after MotoGP had deemed it cool a couple of years earlier when it rained in Qatar. They raced at Brno that year. They raced at Moscow in Russia that year as well, and at the Nürburgring. Brno, which incidentally might well be back on the World Superbike calendar next year if the planned round in Argentina doesn't happen. It's amazing how World Superbikes has changed a lot since then, and also how many things have stayed the same. The likes of Sanx Melandri, Jonathan Rea, who was still slugging it around on a Honda by that point without any of us realising what kind of a monster was going to be awoken once he jumped on a Kawasaki. Gintoli was still around back then. Chas Davies was just arriving in the World Superbike class, having won the World Supersport title the year before. Leon Camier was still sort of slugging around on an uncompetitive machine. He was on a Suzuki back at that point. Some things have stayed the same even to this day in World Superbikes. But that's our number 8, the championship decided from Magny-Cours back in 2012. Number 7, though, sees its head to MotoGP for the first time, for the first of three championship deciders that we have in our countdown. Andre, the first of them comes from 2013. As Marc Marquez's hunt for a rookie title finally came to fruition. In many ways, this is another championship decider that really shouldn't have made it that far, because, of course, Marc Marquez had chances to clinch this title long before then. He could have clinched it at Motegi, but didn't because Lorenzo beat him to the victory there. And really, it was Marc Marquez and Honda's, how can we put this? Their mathematical errors at Phillip Island that really led them into this position.
You mean the fact they forgot to count to 10? That a bit of a problem, that. Phillip Island was a race where the track had just been resurfaced. It was a diamond cut, and, as a result, it chewed up tyres and spat them out. It was a race where, it probably had already cost Scott Redding the Moto2 championship via injury, via enormous high side on tyre dilapidation. So that was fun. So it was a 25-lap race originally. They cut it down to 22, and then they realised, oh, wait, Pirelli could only guarantee, I think it was 10 laps on that
Bridgestone.
Well, Bridgestone, yeah, I was just about that, actually, yeah. They can only guarantee 10 laps of safety on those tyres. So they cut it down to 19 laps of a mandatory pit stop.
You had to pit on either lap 10 or lap 11.
No, was that another lap 9 or lap 10?
Oh, was it? I thought it was lap 11 because it was a 22-lap race, so they gave it half distance. Either way, point being, Repsol Honda thought they knew better than the rules and thought, well, hey, we're allowed to pit on... You've got to pit by lap 10 or lap 11, so we're going to complete 11 laps and then come in on lap 12. It was essentially what Repsol Honda thought they were going to do about this. Not knowing that that's kind of not how the rules are written, guys. Because I remember, I mean, were you like me watching that race live? Because this was pre-bike live. I was watching that race and watching Matt Marquez go past the pit lane exit and thinking, what are you doing?
I was in shock. I was like, guys, this is lap 12. Yeah. What are you doing? Like, what are you actually doing? And next thing you know, Marquez gets black flagged. And I'm like, you idiots. Yeah. All of you.
Well, Julian Ryder calls it on commentary because Eurosport was still calling it back then. So you had Toby and Julian on the call. And as soon as Marc Marquez goes past the pit lane entry, Julian Ryder goes, well, that's a black flag for that. That's a black flag. Like, what's he doing? And then the red flag, the black flag appears with about six laps to go. And Toby Moody's like in shock, like, oh my God. And Julian Ryder's like, no, taking the mic, he's out. Like he said, as soon as that happened, Toby, I said it, black flag. And he was thrown out of the Grand Prix, and Lorenzo had gone to win the race, which set us up for this decider in Valencia, where Matt Marquez needed to finish, I think he needed to finish on the podium, didn't he? He needed to finish third or fourth to win the championship. Lorenzo, who basically had to try and win the race and hope for the best, had a bit of a problem, because of course this wasn't 2017 MotoGP as we know it, where they could quite easily be four, five, six guys who could get in front of Marc Marquez. There were only really two back then, and those were the other Repsol Honda and other factory Yamaha back then, which were ridden as they are now by Danny Pedrosa and Valentino Rossi. So Lorenzo really did the only thing he could, and that was slow the field up.
Yeah, back the pack up, yo. Back the pack up. We went full Lewis Hamilton and Abu Dhabi. We're going to slow this down. Get Bautista in there. Punch Marquez in the throat or something. I don't know.
Yeah, it became a Moto3 race for the early part of that race, where we had Bautista, who was on the Gresini Honda, trying to get involved. But, of course, he wasn't going to make a move on Marc Marquez because he's on a Honda. We had the Tech 3 Yamahas of Cal Crutchlow and Bradley Smith who were keeping up. And that was when I knew that Lorenzo was slowing the field up, because this was Bradley Smith's debut season and he'd never been running with the leading group. I was thinking, hang on, how's Bradley staying with the leader? Oh. Hawke's going slowly here.
The penny had dropped here.
And in the end, as bizarre as it might sound, the guy that perhaps cost Lorenzo any hope of making that strategy work was Lorenzo's own teammate, Valentino Rossi. Because, of course, Lorenzo was trying to get as many people involved in that battle as they can. But really, Dre, the one guy that could have helped him out, his teammate, Valentino Rossi, wasn't quick enough to keep up with the pack.
Exactly. Rossi was like, nah, sod this. I'm just trying to win this race.
Yeah, Rossi just couldn't keep up. Because, of course, Marquez knew at that point he had to get ahead of Lorenzo and stretch them out. As Matt Marquez often does, he threw caution to the wind, didn't he? He went for an overtake that he perhaps shouldn't have gone for. Tried to duff Lorenzo up, which he succeeded in doing. Lorenzo lost ground, and Marquez then basically had to stretch the field out and basically ensure that there weren't any people close to him to make a move and drop him down below third. And once Marc Marquez did that, Valentino Rossi, who was still kind of struggling by that point, he was the perennial fourth guy that year in MotoGP, as Marquez, Pedrosa and Lorenzo would dominate the podiums most of the year. Valentino Rossi just could not match that pace of Marc Marquez. So Marquez would end up gapping fourth place to Valentino Rossi, which left him in a pretty safe third place, and winning the championship. And Marc Marquez, given what he's achieved since then, it's still worth mentioning, Dre, because he's become the best rider in the world and will probably become one of the greatest riders that this sport has ever seen. But it still bears mentioning that this was a rookie Marc Marquez who was winning the MotoGP world title at the very first attempt.
Indeed, and I don't think we quite realised at the time how magnificent that was. There was a guy that's come in his first season, has beaten, you know, like the three established veterans of the upper class of MotoGP, with Rossi, Lorenzo and Pedrosa being established as the as the elder statesman, but also just the three best riders on the planet, and Marquez had come in and beaten them as a rookie. It was special. It was the first real sign that this kid is a freak, and it's only gone on to greater things for him since then, but. This is where it all began. Essentially, this is the season that proved that Marquez is as good as any rider on the planet right out of the box, and we've not seen anything like that since. And I'm not sure if we'll ever see anything quite like that again.
Yeah,
we've seen it now with Maverick, and he technically wasn't a rookie.
Yeah,
this is his first season.
Yeah, I know. It's still one of the sort of shining moments I've had as a writer, where I did a season preview that year for the Checkered Flag, who I still write for now. And did a rider-by-rider season preview and sort of gave a championship prediction for each rider. And did this, obviously, back before Qatar that year, back in March, and it's still to my great pride and credit that I predicted Marc Marquez to win the title in his rookie season. And a number of people, like, when I was sort of talking about this in the pub before the season started, were looking at me sort of sideways thinking, what? And I was just like, watch this kid go. Just watch him. He is a freak, Marc Marquez. Having seen what he'd done in 125 and then in Moto2 in the previous years, I was thinking, this kid is just freakishly good. And because Repsol Honda were kind of in a tough spot around that time, Dre, because they were trying to have to answer the question, how do you prepare for life after Casey Stoner? Of course, Marquez answered it pretty quickly.
Yeah, it's like, somewhere Jonathan Rea is like furiously like cutting
onions. Yeah, because he'd, of course, just become a stand-in, hadn't he? He'd replaced Stoner that previous year for two races at Repsol Honda, but of course the spot that, because Honda for years, that's why Jonathan Rea stayed at that team for so long, because Honda were like, no, when the time's right, we want to put you into MotoGP, Johnny. But a guy called Marc Marquez came along and they were like, plans have changed. Plans have changed, I'm afraid. We've got this Marquez kid who's a bit good.
Forgive us.
And he went on to win the championship in his rookie season. And really, it was his maturity, despite the fact that he was 20 years old, it was his maturity that won the championship. Of course, both Pedrosa and Lorenzo had injuries that year. Jorge, of course, famously broke his collarbone at Assen. And Pedrosa did the same the round afterwards at the Sachsenring. And it was Marc Marquez, Dre, who basically took the mature approach. He didn't get injured. He wasn't the crasher that perhaps some people label him as now. It was that really that gave him that head start. Once he had those points on the board and that advantage, he really put his foot on their throats, didn't he? And became the Marc Marquez that we know now, who would just go on to dominate.
Yeah, just went on and just crushed it. It was as simple as that. I mean, it helps the guy is made of basically rubber.
Yeah.
After having like a 210 mile an hour crash at Mugello earlier that season, but hey, who's counting? it's one of those things where you just go, yeah. Sometimes, you know, staying healthy is the best way of going about it. Your best ability is your rider, is your availability. Mm. And that's what worked out for Marquez in the end. I'll also give another shout out to a good mate of mine as well, Liam Jenkins, who used to be a big-time motorsport commentator. He was the only other guy that I saw that had the confidence to say Marquez was going to win that title. And he stuck to his guns, and he ended up being proven completely right.
Yeah, he did. Marquez has... Marquez has pretty much won everything in sight since 2015 apart. Yeah, he's been that good in MotoGP. We will come back to MotoGP and two other title deciders that got the world talking. In the second half of our countdown, we've got one more to go before we break off for the news, and that is number six. And for the first time, we head to BSB and to Brands Hatch, which is kind of timely, given that they're there this weekend for the title decider. It's 2013, and this is the point of the show where Rebecca James really wishes she were not in Australia, and we're here talking about this, because this was the one, Dre, where Alex Lowes became British Superbike champion. And a very tense day. I mean, there are so many other championship deciders which produce excitement or produce controversy. We have some later on which produce both in equal measure. This was just straight up tense, wasn't it? Because, of course, this was a wet Sunday at Brands Hatch where Alex Lowes and Shaky Byrne kind of, from memory, they almost tried to hand each other the championship, because, of course, Alex Lowes in race one of the Sunday, because, of course, they ran on the Saturday as well. Alex Lowes crashes out of that race in the wet conditions, only for Shaky Byrne to do exactly the same thing in that race and set up this final race decider between the two.
Exactly. It was a weekend of attrition, so to speak. And it was a weekend where both guys had made mistakes that had opened the door for other people to take advantage of. And yeah, it's it's what led to this essential, like, winner-take-all 2013 final round showdown.
Yeah, we had the controversy earlier in the season, the controversy that Bex probably doesn't want us to mention, where Alex Lowe's famously wiped Shaky Byrne out at Assen round before, in a move that got Alex Lowe's disqualified from that race, given that they deemed him at fault for it. But he ended up going to the final round at Brands with a slim points lead. And what made this final round for me so impressive, the final decider, was that because they'd both crashed out of that second race in the wet conditions, they were both way down on the grid for the final round of the season. Alex Lowe's had to start ninth on the grid. Shaky Byrne had to start 22nd on the grid. And to his immense credit, Shaky Byrne managed to slice his way through the field. And in the end, we had Josh Brooks winning the race. One of the forgotten facts from that weekend at Brands in 2013, Josh Brooks did a triple and won all three races. Which just shows you how bad his showdown had gone, because he won all three races and still didn't win the title because he was that far back already. But Alex Lowe's and Shaky Byrne, despite having started on the third row and the eighth row respectively, were battling for second in the end. And Alex Lowe's, who was still in his very, very early 20s by that point, Dre, held his nerve in a final lap showdown with the guy who at that point was going for a record fourth title.
Indeed, Lowe's put the wall up, and there was nothing Shaky could do about it in the end. And yeah, Shaky had to follow Lowe's home in third, and it was enough for a very young Alex Lowe's to win the title. And it was tense, it was dramatic, it was a weekend where it had gone back and forth pretty much the whole way through. And Josh Brooks was sitting there punching his fuel tank, thinking, "What could have been if I hadn't completely blown the first round?" Yeah. But it was a great finale, and one where, you know, we saw another new young star come through the class.
Yeah, it was a real coming of age moment for Alex Lowe. So, of course, he'd signed for the Samsung Honda team that season alongside Yuichi Kiyonari, who was returning to the championship, and many sort of saw that as, oh yeah, Kiyonari is going to be the returning hero, is going to challenge Shaky for the title. And we've got, and you know, Alex Lowe's is a teammate who'll learn the way, and ended up being the other way around. It was Alex Lowe's who would take up the championship battle for that team, as Kiyonari sort of struggled to readjust to life back in BSB again. He didn't really adjust at all until a couple of years later. And this was one title to the side which probably could have made the list had Kiyonari not got injured, because of course he injured himself at Brands in 2014 as he and Shaky were going for the title, which robbed us of what would have been a brilliant title decider back that year. And in the end, we didn't get one. But we got one in 2013 as Alex Lowe's really came of age that year and won the British Superbike title. And we've got five more to go, and we will come to those shortly. But first, let's do the news. And we mentioned right at the top of the show that championships were up for grabs last weekend, including the Speedway GP title, but Jason Doyle has not won it, which might not disappoint him, because it means he'll have to clinch it at his home round in Australia instead. But he went to Torin looking to win the championship, and in the end, Patrick Dudek, his nearest championship rival, took 18 points from the weekend and the overall victory to cut Doyle's lead to 14 points and keep the championship alive heading into the final round. Doyle, who failed to make the final and therefore lost a lot of points, he goes to the final round in Australia 14 points ahead of Patrick Dudek in the championship with 21 up for grabs. And that's basically if Dudek sweeps the board and wins all seven races he takes part in that night, which is a very rare achievement in Speedway. So Doyle needs a maximum of 8 points from the final round in Australia at the Etihad Stadium in Melbourne in a couple of weeks' time to clinch the championship. One championship that has been decided, though, is the Moto3 Junior World Championship. We flagged this up last week. Dennis Foggia going to Aragon, looking to win the championship, and he has done just that. He didn't win the race at Aragon. That went to Jean Messia, a rider who we've told you about a few times this season, particularly when he impressed us in Austria. Messia took the victory, but it wasn't enough to keep the championship alive. Foggia finishing close behind him, and Dennis Foggia has become the Moto3 Junior World Champion, and of course will head into the Grand Prix class with Skyview 46 this season as Junior Champion. Now, Moto2 news, and this is the first of a few stories that concern next year. Moto2 news for the Stop and Go team. They've confirmed their riders for next season. I know you're all on tenterhooks waiting to find out who they are. Isaac Vinales is one of them. He stays with that team, and they've signed up a Moto3 youngster. No, it's not that one. Nor that one. No, I'll just tell you. It's Jules Danilo, who's moved up. The crowd goes mild at that one. He's joining his teammate, Romano Fenati, who, of course, is also moving up to Moto2 next season with the Marinelli Snipers team. Danilo is moving up with Stop and Go, which would indicate that he's got a bit of money behind him. because he's going to be moving up to Moto2 next season. Now, this story is much more important, and we'll have much more of you interested, because this is World Superbike news, because Red Bull Honda have confirmed their other rider for next season, because we expect Stefan Bradl to be staying on board with that team. We believe he has a contract for next season, and given that he's sponsored by Red Bull, Red Bull are keen for Bradl to stay on board at that team for next season. Dre, we now know his teammate and the perennial rider for hire has finally bagged himself a full-on factory ride.
Rider for hire got paid! Yes! Here for it. I guess I can't call him rider for hire no more. That's actually kind of sad. But yes, Leon Kamea will be in on one of those Red Bull Hondas next year with Tenkate, and good for him, because he's a guy that has been deserving of quality machinery ever since dragging that scrap heap of an MV to semi-decent finishing positions. He's done a fantastic job with that, and I'm glad that he's being rewarded for it, with hopefully a project that can get him up the field in later weeks and months, and hopefully not too long before Honda finds themselves in a better position than they were before. Because Kamea is a quality rider. He's done fantastic work for MV, and I'm glad he's been rewarded.
Yeah, you can see Kamea play a key role for that team, can't you? Because he's got so much experience in World Superbikes. From his time with Aprilia, his time with Suzuki, as I mentioned earlier on, and more recently with MV Agusta. He, for better or for worse, I don't think Kamea necessarily enjoys having this reputation, but he's earned a reputation as a great rider at developing a bike. Of course, he's been the sole rider for MV Agusta for a number of years, and I think the main reason MV have wanted Kamea as their sole rider is because he's so good at sort of leading the development of a bike. And of course, if you've got a teammate who's giving you completely different information, it muddies the waters a bit. So Kamea's done such a good job at bringing that MV on, and I think the reason... and one of the many reasons that MV Agusta have made such progress in recent years is because of Kamea, who's done such a great job for them. And he's not been rewarded with the results because that bike has struggled to make the finish without braking. But for better or for worse, Drake, Kamea has this reputation. And really, a rider who is adept at developing a bike and making a bad bike better is really what Red Bull Honda need right now.
Exactly. They need a development guy. They need a guy that can get on there and find ways of making the bike better. A guy that, you know, provides good feedback and is, you know, willing to take his time to get, you know, to figure this out, basically. And, you know, that was probably the best way of summing up Honda this year, was figuring it out right now, especially with all the negative stuff that's happened with them this year. They need a consistent guy on that seat that's going to be able to develop it and get it up there. And Kamea could very well be that guy. So I think it's a great fit for the Red Bull Honda team. And hopefully it'll be the first to sign of some brighter times coming into that team after a disastrous 2017 season.
Yeah, it's been the season from hell for that team. And yeah, we wish Leon Kamea and Red Bull Honda all the best. I think that's a great fit. A welcome payday for Leon Kamea, who's been, as I say, slumming it around on an MV Agusta for the last few years that hasn't necessarily rewarded him with the results his riding has deserved. And also for the team, who've managed to find probably the best rider available. I mean, Loris Baz is available and was in talks with that team, but given who's out there and given that the big four seats are taken up by arguably the four best riders in the championship at the moment, and of course we've got the Yamaha seats that are filled as well, Lowe's and Manmax staying on board. I don't think Red Bull Honda can really expect to have done an awful lot better than Kamea, given how badly their season's gone. They haven't really put the greatest advert together to sign a quality rider to their team, have they?
Quote-unquote quality rider, yeah, exactly. And yeah, I think you're right. I think Kamea is definitely the best guy available, and I think that was one that definitely made the most sense. Baz is possible, but Baz is a bit of an outlier because, again, he's not been in the class for, you know, 4 years now. So for me, yeah, I think that was the best move they could have possibly gotten. They got a guy that's in the top five or six at his best on a bike that we know is not competitive compared to some of the other stronger factory units that are in World Superbikes right now. So I think that was an excellent hire for him. And again, as I said, I think that was the best hire they could have possibly gotten.
Does Loris Baz go to MV, I wonder?
Because
I'm trying to think, because in many ways Baz and Kamea are alike in that they are probably too tall for motorcycles. So in many ways he'd be the like-for-like replacement for Kamea at MV. But MV Agusta, of course, have spoken in recent months that they want to expand to a two-rider lineup for next season. Well, they now have two riders to find rather than one. One who's been linked for a number of weeks has been their factory rider in Super Sport, which is PJ Jacobsen. who has ridden superbikes before, but that was, of course, that was British superbikes back in the early part of this decade. He rode in BSB. He was on the grid in that famous race that we mentioned a moment ago with Alex Lowes and Shaky Byrne. PJ Jacobson was on the front row of the grid for it. So he knows how to ride a superbike, but he's been riding super sport for the last few years. But he might be who MV Agusta ends up turning to for next season, because if they do run two riders next season, they have got two spots to fill because their current rider is off to Honda. MotoGP news for next season, and we've spoken actually in recent weeks about how the grid for next season is confirmed, every spot confirmed, because every rider on the grid has a contract. Well, that's not necessarily been true, because there has been a bit of doubt surrounding the second seat at KTM. Paul Espargaro's safe, but there has been talk, Dre, in recent weeks that Bradley Smith's spot might be under fire, and the man taking aim would be Mika Kallio, the test rider. Well, KTM have clarified matters this week. It's almost like that vote of confidence that you give an under-pressure manager in football, where KTM have declared and have given a vote of confidence for Bradley Smith and said he is still our race rider for next year. And is he a tad lucky?
A bit. I think so, to be honest with you. It's one of those things where you just go, well, it was dodgy, because the way that Bradley was going about himself, I was worried for him. I was worried that, you know, Kallio would come along, has made him look a bit silly on a couple of occasions, and I was sitting there thinking, this could be bad, basically. And yeah, I'm glad that Bradley's been given a second chance to really get it together, but this is like the second get your shit together Bradley moment of his MotoGP career already, because we've been here before with Bradley. Hopefully he gets the crack of these Michelin tires quickly, otherwise he's going to be in big trouble.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny how that vote of confidence he got from Hervé Poncharal a couple of years ago really basically transformed him into a top six MotoGP rider the year after. And it was funny as well, because I noticed him from free practice today. Bradley Smith was ahead of Paul Espargaro in both sessions at Motegi. Who was it who mentioned it in BT Sports commentary? Neil Hodgson mentioned it in the first Moto 3 session this morning, before I decided to tag out and go to bed, where he talks about, because he was talking about John McPhee and how he doesn't have a contract yet for 2018 at the British talent team. And he talks about how many riders around the world from perhaps different nationalities, that fear of being out of a job acts as inspiration. It fires them up to do better. And that's almost what Alberto Pucci is trying to do with John McPhee. But Neil Hodgson's point was, it seems with British riders, it almost has the opposite effect. It puts so much pressure on them that they end up sort of going into their shells a bit. And it's almost like the British riders seem to need the security of having a ride for the next season to actually deliver at their best. And Smith's almost another example of that.
Exactly. It's definitely a thing where it's like he's a confidence rider. He's a rider that likes having confidence. And if it doesn't work out for him, then he goes away a little bit. That's when he starts to struggle. And yeah, that could be a problem for Bradley. So I hope the faith injection that's been put into this by giving him another contract for another year gets him back up the field a little bit.
Yeah, and it'll be interesting to see next season if he starts slowly and then Kallio rocks up for his first wild card at wherever that'll be, Argentina or somewhere, who knows, or Jerez, where Kallio figures, because that is going to be interesting. You almost wonder whether that might change mid-season if Bradley's struggles continue. I mean, in terms of Kallio, I think Kallio can count himself a bit unlucky, because he could not have done any more in his wildcard outings to say to the team that I deserve to put on a race rider. But part of me does think, and I appreciate part of this is the Bradley Smith fan in me talking here, but it's almost like cricket, because you hear this a lot in cricket where someone becomes better when they're out of the team. It's one of those where, you know, a player becomes a better player when they're out of the team, because you want them in the team ahead of the guy that's currently on in the spot right now. And part of me thinks whether that's the case with Kallio, where he hadn't really done an awful lot in his MotoGP career, because he has been in MotoGP before, to suggest that this level of performance would be in him on a consistent basis. And I still have a slight element of doubt where, if they put Kallio on the bike regularly next season, would he be able to, without the same level of testing that he's had this year, and the benefit of new development parts and all that sort of stuff, would Kallio be able to produce that level of performance 18 times a year rather than on 3 or 4 wildcard outings next year? That's still the doubt I have in my mind, Dre.
How much of that was the Bradley Smith in you talking?
part of it. But I think it's worth mentioning though, because the roles would be reversed, wouldn't they, next season? If Callio's struggling on a KTM factory race bike next season, and then Bradley rocks up at Jerez as a wild card and smokes Callio, just imagine the criticism KTM would come in for.
Yeah, you make a very valid point. That you know, Callio has not been in this position before, where you know he's not had a consistent race seat before for a long time. And yeah, like there's definitely something to be said about the possibility that you know it might not work out. And yeah, I get it.
I feel for Callio. I Callio could have done absolutely no more. I mean, his wildcard outings. I mean, hell, he finished in the top 10 at Austria earlier this year and ran with the leaders. He was fifth in free practice in his last outing at Aragon and finished 11th ahead of Bradley again. So Callio could have done no more than he's done. But I think Bradley Smith's worth persevering with. I think he's shown enough in his MotoGP career to suggest that when he clicks on a MotoGP bike, he's shown he can beat Paul regularly. If he's got the bike underneath him, so I think this is without question. This is the you called it the second get your shit together contract that Bradley's had. I think this is the definite last chance saloon for Bradley, because he many people thought, including me, that was his last chance at Tech 3 when he was given that extra year, and of course he justified that fate with the best season of his life. I think if he doesn't deliver next season, that will be the end of Bradley Smith as a MotoGP rider, without any question, next season. As far as the rider that's taken his place at Tech 3 this year is concerned, Jonas Folger, who's really impressed us throughout the year, he'd gone a bit quiet in recent races, both at Misano and at Aragon. We hadn't really seen Jonas Folger up the front that much. Dre, I think we've now had the explanation why. It's been something rather out of Folger's control.
Yeah, the man's got a pretty nasty virus by the looks of it, and he's going to likely be on the shelf for most likely all three flyaway rounds now, which is very sad to hear. Was having a great rookie season, but now it turns out he's been suffering through this for a little while, and it's a shame because he's been very, very strong this season, and yeah, now his season's been effectively derailed by this. So God, I wish Jonas a speedy one, but yeah, he's not in the best of health right now.
Yeah, he's unfortunately for Jonas Folger, he's a victim of the calendar, isn't he, in many ways, of course, because the races come so thick and fast now every weekend for the next three weekends. Unfortunately, Folger finds himself on the shelf for now. I mean, he's mentioned in the press release from the team that he suffered from the Epstein-Barr virus in the past. So he doesn't know at the minute if it's this. He's got to go back to Munich for tests to find out what the actual extent of his issues are. But speaking in the Tech 3 press release, Folger said that he came to Japan and was motivated for the three flyaways, but he's been feeling really weak since the Misano and Aragon rounds. And on arrival in Japan, he's been struggling with his energy levels. Even leaving the hotel room was impossible for me. And unfortunately, I had to miss some Yamaha events, which I'm very sorry for. He met with Hervé on Wednesday night, and they agreed to go for a check with the doctors. And he met the clinical mobility team, and they've advised me to return to Germany right away for a series of blood tests. I mean, the guy's not well.
No, that he's sick. He is sick. There is no other way of saying it. He is legitimately very ill and he's got a serious problem.
Hervé Poncharalo said that he is 99% that he won't be at Phillip Island either. And don't know about you, Dre, but if I was going to return from a pretty bad virus, the one place I wouldn't want to return is in the sweltering heat of Sepang either. So I'm not so sure we'll see Folger until Valencia. A good opportunity for someone else, though. Young Japanese rider Kota Nozane, who's one of the Yamaha test riders. He was one of the other riders who was in the frame to replace Valentino Rossi had he not made it back for Aragon. Nozane, handily being Japanese, is in Motegi this weekend and is replacing Folger, and was bloody impressive in free practice on Friday as well. He was right on the pace of the two factory Yamahas in the wet, in 13th place. So Nozane doing a cracking job on the second of the Tech 3 Yamahas this weekend in place of Folger as teammate to Joan Zarco. Joan Zarco, incidentally, impressed us all in the mini-moto race that they had at Motegi on Thursday, one of the favourite features for me of the Japanese Grand Prix weekend, where they pull out the electric mini motorbikes and have a race around on those. Race that was won by Tito Rabat, incidentally, his first win for a couple of years. So that took place. Head to MotoGP's Facebook, by the way, if you haven't watched that. It is a very, very funny video indeed of what took place on Thursday at Motegi. BSB news then, and we'll be coming back to BSB before we go at the end of the show, because of course they're at their final round of the season at Brands Hatch this weekend for the season finale, the triple header around the GP circuit. Andre, one man who will be on the grid is Kyle Wright, who unfortunately his World Supersport campaign ended rather early as his Kawasaki Pichetti team cut him with two rounds to go. After his season kind of derailed. He's back this weekend for FS3 Kawasaki in place of the still injured Billy McConnell. And if we go back to British Supersport days, Kyle Wright has already shown that on British shores, he's arguably as good as anyone. So this is going to be an exciting one-off sort of cameo role for Wright to see what he can do and perhaps earn himself a BSB ride next year.
Exactly. I mean, this is your advert right here, more than anything else. He needs to find something here. Would be ideal. It's a bit of a changeable conditions weekend. Rain is predicted. We had rain in FP1, which has been going on as we record this episode. It's a great opportunity for Kyle Wright to show himself. I mean, this would be the perfect sort of class for him to re-establish himself after maybe being given a little bit too much too soon in World Supersport alongside Keenan. I mean, that was always going to be a challenge to be Keenan's teammate there. Having to lean on him even more after Keenan got hurt, it was bad news for him. I think it was almost like an unwinnable situation for Kyle Wright, really. So again, a fresh start in BSB might be the way to go.
Incidentally, that first few practice session of BSB and Brands, which has just finished as we record this, Shaky Byrne fastest in that with Leon Haslam down in 14. Shaky Byrne will be somehow running down to race direction saying, any chance we can make this the grid for race one on the Saturday with Haslam down in 14th? We need it to give us a championship. Byrne fastest from Dixon and Brooks in that first session. So the men in 2nd, 3rd and 4th in the championship were 1st, 2nd and 3rd, not in that order. But Haslam down in 14th in that first few practice session, which as Dre mentioned, was rain affected. Kyle Wright was the slowest rider out there. He was down in 25th place, but still very early days. One other piece of BSB news, and we'll make this very quick. They've confirmed the calendar for next year. Spoiler alert, it's exactly the same as this year's. Only one even slight alteration I've noticed, and that's that Snetterton and Knockhill are the other way around. But essentially, it's the same circuits in near enough the same order, with the same three, Alton Park, Assen and Silverstone, making up the showdown in 2018. That is the 2018 British Superbike calendar. When we return, we will resume our countdown of our top 10 title deciders, and we'll be heading back to MotoGP in Valencia for one of the shining moments in the history of MotoGP. With us on Bike Live, and let's resume our countdown of our favourite championship deciders at number 5, and we're heading back to Dre, probably the greatest MotoGP season, perhaps arguably up until last year, that we've ever seen, 2006, and the championship decider between Valentino Rossi and Nicky Hayden, a championship that can be pretty much made into a movie based on how it panned out that year. And both riders had very, very different roads to this decider in Valencia. Valentino Rossi, who had been the dominant force in MotoGP for the last 5 years, suddenly found a Yamaha that didn't really want to play ball. It wasn't quick on some occasions, and it wasn't reliable at others. And we'll come on to Hayden in a moment, but for Valentino Rossi to come from where he came from to head into Valencia with a shot was quite an impressive feat in itself.
It was indeed, because Yamaha was a donkey that year. It retired. It wasn't particularly quick on occasion. It had numerous mechanical failures that had hurt Valentino Rossi on several occasions. And he was limping, this champion, but he still found a way to be leading going into the final round. Something to do with that race in Estoril. We never talk about that. It's one of those things where going into the final round, Rossi still had a very large advantage because of Estoril and obviously the Danny Pedrosa takeout that heard around the world. Fun times, indeed. And yeah, Valentino Rossi still pretty much controlled his own destiny going into that one.
He did. And Nicky Hayden, the aforementioned, he had a very different route to the championship because he was really leading from the front for most of that season. He wasn't doing it by virtue of weight of victories, more weight of podiums that year. He only won two races in that 2006 season, two of his three all-time MotoGP race wins. And they were dramatic, weren't they? In particular, his race win at Assen, where he denied Colin Edwards what would have been Colin Edwards' first and only MotoGP win at the final chicane at Assen when they went side by side and only one of them came out on the other side of it, that one being Nicky Hayden. But heading into Estoril, which we have to mention, we can't mention 2006 and the title decided without talking Estoril, Nicky Hayden actually went into Estoril with a chance of winning it there and then. But the circumstances certainly didn't play out that. Like, rather than winning the championship, he almost went to the point of losing it.
Exactly. As we talk about that, his teammate got a bit too overzealous on the bumper turn six, and next thing you know, they're both down. And Nicky Hayden looked like he was about to rip Danny Pedrosa's head clean off his spine, like something out of a Mortal Kombat fatality. It wasn't pretty, to say the least. And yeah, Valentino Rossi would go on to wait. He didn't win. What do you mean Tony Elias got there first?
Yeah, yeah, by 0.02 of a second. In still the greatest race I think MotoGP's ever seen at Estoril back in 2006. Tony Elias, the saviour of Honda, as Julian Ryder termed him.
Back the dumpster truck up.
Yeah, back the dumpster truck of gold, of watches, of diamonds, the whole lot for Tony Elias, who rescued Honda by costing Valentino Rossi 5 points on that day. 5 points that would actually come in rather handy for Nicky Hayden come the next round at Valencia, where Nicky Hayden's task was to win the race, essentially, with Valentino Rossi third or lower in that round. So Nicky Hayden had sort of made the point to Danny Pedrosa as they tried to reconcile at Repsol Honda that, hey, if we go 1-2 at the final round in Valencia, we can repair this. We can still win the championship. And it was astonishing, really, Dre. The circumstances of that title decider are astonishing. Where Valentino Rossi's on pole position, Nicky Hayden's with him on the front row of the grid, and Valentino Rossi really makes a hole at the start, drops back at the start, including a little elbow in his side by Nicky Hayden on the way past down to turn one.
Just making sure.
Yeah, just making sure. I still love that shot of the onboard as Nicky Hayden comes up alongside him and just sort of rests his elbow on Valentino Rossi as they're on the brakes for turn one. Yeah, I'm coming for this championship, Valet. And Valentino ends up dropping down to sort of 7th or 8th at the start of that race with Nicky Hayden up the road, and in real time, with 2-3 laps gone in that race, Nicky Hayden's in position to win the world championship, and Valentino Rossi, Dre, is not making any progress, which led to perhaps the most astonishing and the biggest error, arguably, of Valentino Rossi's entire MotoGP career.
Yeah, I think you know. He skies it, and it's like, whoa! Where are you going, Valentino? He clearly pushed himself too hard, and he had an enormous frigging high side. Which effectively ended his championship hopes. He was able to continue, but he was just obviously just too far back at that point to really make a difference. The bike was damaged, and yeah, he essentially gift-wrapped the title to Nicky Hayden.
Yeah, Nicky Hayden, who then only really had to finish third or fourth to win the championship. He finished third behind the Ducatis of Troy Bayliss and Loris Caparossi. Bayliss winning, having just wrapped up a dominant World Superbike title in 2006, turned up at MotoGP's final round and won that too. Because he was in that kind of form that year, Bayliss. Incidentally, you'll hear a bit more about Bayliss in a moment when we get to number four. But an astonishing ride from him and a Ducati 1-2 with Nicky Hayden in third. And I have to say, Dre, and it becomes even more emotional given what's happened this year with Nicky, sadly. But I don't think I've ever seen a championship victory, a successful moment, a victorious moment in a rider's career met with such raw emotion. As that one of all these 10 title ties we've had, I don't think any of them match this one for pure emotion.
Yeah, definitely. It came to emotions, when it came to just seeing the sheer joy on Nicky Hayden's face at achieving his lifelong dream. And oh man, gosh, like his dad was there. We had the traditional Valencia fireworks celebration, and like It was like the man's birthday and Christmas had been rolled into one in one fell swoop. He was the happiest man on the planet at that point in time. It was ridiculous. It was emotional. It was beautiful. It was a wonderful time, and you could see just how much it meant to Nikki to win that championship. And it's a scene and an image that I will never forget.
Yeah.
I've seen him on the like helmet off, just in sheer ecstasy.
The image that sort of sticks with me. It gives me goosebumps thinking about it. But of course, there's the famous moment as Valentino Rossi pulls alongside Nikki Hayden and sort of rests his hand on his arm and congratulates him for the championship. And Nikki Hayden almost sort of bows his head as if to say, "I'm not worthy." He still sort of feels a bit sheepish, even though he's just beaten the guy to the world title back in 2006. Yeah. So of course, this was peak Valentino Rossi. This was him in his pomp back in 2006, when he was the dominant rider in motorcycle sport. And Nikki Hayden beat him to a world title. The only guy in that 990 era to beat Valentino Rossi to a world championship back in that era. That puts it into perspective what Nikki Hayden did that year. And the quote that still sticks with me from Nikki Hayden, because of course he'd had that huge low at Estoril, followed by the huge height of Valencia, and the quote still sticks to me. It still gives me goosebumps now, where he said, "You know, I'm just a firm believer that good things happen to good people." And of course, that happened to Nikki that day when he won the world championship and realised his dream. That is number five. I'm incredibly analyst. I know that will be one that gets you all sort of tweeting us with disgust. @_101. You got that at number five. But yeah, we've got four incredible ones.
Sorry,
to come.
Bro.
And we're heading to World Superbikes next for number four. And Imola of 2002. There have been many great races since, Dre. Admittedly, not many of them this year. But this race perhaps would still go down. This race still stands the test of time, doesn't it? And arguably one of the greatest World Superbike races of all time between Colin Edwards and Troy Bayliss.
Indeed, and these were two guys at the absolute peak of their powers. Two guys that, you know, were... But it's one of those things where you look at it and you go, "Wait, you thought this would be a bit higher, didn't you?" It was a dogfight between, you know, Bayliss and Edwards, who were in their primes, and you know those two were a country mile ahead of anybody else in the championship. They were the dominant guys by a mile, and it all came down to Imola 2002.
They won every single race bar one between them that year. The only race that they didn't win was Makoto Tamada, who wildcarded on a Honda in the Japanese round that year, which I think was at Suzuka from memory. I'll check up on that one. But yeah, Tamada wildcarded in Japan on a Japanese motorcycle and then won one of the two races. Other than that, Edwards and Bayliss swept the board in 2002. And really, around sort of two-thirds distance in that season, Bayliss pretty much had it won. He was 58 points ahead of Colin Edwards in the championship. Colin Edwards would then go on to win the last nine races in a row.
Ridiculous.
To win the championship, including, crucially, the penultimate round at Assen, where Bayliss crashed out of race two and basically went from 19 points ahead to 1 point behind heading into the final weekend. Edwards would then beat Bayliss in race one at Imola, which meant in race two, and this is probably the reason that this isn't higher than number four, Colin Edwards didn't actually need to win the race. It wasn't a winner-takes-all showdown. It was a Bayliss must win and back him up. It's similar to Lorenzo at Valencia. And actually, with about five laps to go, it looks as if Bayliss is actually going to do it, as he's backing Colin Edwards into his teammate Ruben Zaus on the second of the Infostrada Hondas, Ducati, should I say. And unfortunately, Edwards is able to up the pace again, and it ends up becoming the straight fight between the two. But I have to say, Dre, watching that race yesterday via totally illegal sources, I might add.
Of course.
I forgot how great that race. And do you know what else I've forgotten? Imola was absolutely packed to the rafters that day. And the absolute roars when Edwards and Bayliss are going side by side through Tozer. They do the Tozer hairpin where there's that grass bank on the outside, and it's absolutely packed with spectators. 2002, late 2002, we're pretty much talking here, aren't we, of when World Superbikes was at its absolute peak.
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, World Superbikes was arguably bigger than MotoGP, but Valentino Rossi was the guy at that point, but this was before Rossi had really established his legacy.
The MotoGP era was just getting started.
It was just getting started, and the quality of field wasn't as strong in MotoGP back then. Worlds, I'd argue, still had the better top-tier roster with Edwards, Bayliss, Hodson, Noriyuki Hargus was still a thing, Ben Bostrom, Ruben Zaus, a young James Toseland.
Yeah, 21-year-old James Toseland.
Yeah, what happened to him? But yeah, it's one of those things where the World Superbike field was still arguably stronger than MotoGP's at that point in time. And yeah, it was still like it was still carrying a lot of the big weight of TV networks and fans. You know, but the MotoGP era was still kind of like separate, so to speak. And Worlds was still, I think, like the peak of what it was now. And yeah, this was the prime time fight that people were looking for.
Yeah, Tamada's win. It was at Sugo. It wasn't at Suzuka
that year.
Because World Superbikes, of course, that year, it was at that time, it was still benefiting from the BBC TV coverage. BBC treat it as the pinnacle back then. Yes. Of course, BBC weren't showing MotoGP back at that stage. They were showing World Superbikes because it arguably had the better riders. It had the British interest because there wasn't really any British rider of note in MotoGP around that point. It was really Jeremy McWilliams and that was it. So, you know, many British fans were interested in the fortunes of Neil Hodgson, of James Toseland. By that point, of course, Neil Hodgson would go on to win the title the following year in 2003. But yeah, an astonishing race between Edwards and Bayliss. And yeah, like that was the main thing that stuck with me. The main takeaway I had from watching that race again 15 years on was just, my God, the circuit is absolutely full. And you can hear the crowd over the bikes as Edwards and Bayliss are knocking spots off each other on the final lap. And in many ways, just that race, I mean, it didn't end up deciding the championship because Edwards, even if he'd followed Bayliss home, he would have won the title by a point. But just watching those two, as you say, Dre, at the peak of their powers, just go to war for 21 laps, it's a race that even 15 years on, you can't tire of watching.
Exactly. It's a classic. There's no other way of describing it. It's an absolute classic. But, you know, it's symbolic of World Superbikes. It was arguably the last real amazing World Superbike moment of this era where just seeing those two guys just absolutely pummel the shit out of each other. Mm. And, again, those were the two best guys in Worlds by a country mile at that point in time. And they wrote their own story for the championship. And, you know, Bayliss just about came out behind, but Edwards was phenomenal to close out the season.
And that was Edwards' farewell. He then moved on to MotoGP after that in 2003. Bayliss would come back and, of course, would go on to win another two world titles to end up with three World Superbike crowns, which now has him tie for second with Jonathan Rea in the all-time World Superbike list. But, yeah, just an astonishing 2002 season. It's a race where you can still find sort of like highlights edits of it on YouTube somewhere, and I would really encourage you to go and watch it. It is a brilliant race between the two. Just basically watching Colin Edwards throw caution to the wind on that final lap to try and win the race when he flat out doesn't need to, because all he needs to do is follow Troy Bayliss home. But Colin Edwards wanted to go out and depart World Superbikes with a final victory, and that's exactly in the end what he did. Now, four to go in our list, four races to go, and at number four, three races to go, and we head to MotoGP once again, and 2015. You didn't think we'd leave this one out, did you? Rossi versus Lorenzo at Valencia in 2015. A race, really, Dre, in many ways, the finale wasn't really as good as the build-up that preceded it. The finale was really shaped by the build-up that preceded it. It was the race where, of course, Valentino Rossi had to come from the back of the grid based on what happened in Sepang. And really, as much as this showdown didn't end up with the result that many of the punters wanted to see, this race perhaps was, you know, never were more eyes on a MotoGP race than this one. This perhaps can go down even now as perhaps the biggest MotoGP race of all time.
Arguably, certainly the most important, I'd argue. Yeah, we all know the story of Sepang and Philip Islander, how we got to this point, and how Marc Marquez was basically directly involved in the title fight, despite not actually being in the title fight. We all know what happened at Sepang. We all know, what Rossi did or did not do. And, you know, the fact he had to start from the back of the grid and all of a sudden people cared about MotoGP again. It's like, oh, hey, guys, where have you been the last 3 years? But no. Despite that, Valentino Rossi was directly involved in a chase from the back to try and win the title. So, of course, people were going to be invested. I remember the build-up to that race. You saw a bunch of people that are never normally there for MotoGP races all just rock up there, like, expecting something magical to happen. Like I think Martin Brundle was down there. I remember Mark Webber being down there, who, you know, both of them were huge Valentino Rossi marks.
Yeah, MotoGP was back-page news back in late 2015, which I hadn't seen in my time watching. I'd never seen MotoGP make it into the public sporting consciousness that much beyond its own sport. It transcended MotoGP that year.
Yes, it did. It absolutely did, and it got everybody in motorsport talking after Sepang. I remember people like Jason Plato was coming out here releasing like super zoomed in GIFs, trying to analyze this footage. People from all over the biking world was being asked for comments. I remember Michael Laverty saying, "Choke the Moto 3 dudes out that get involved in the title race." And I'm like, wow, okay. That's a strong take there, Michael. A bad one, but a strong take nonetheless. But it's one of those things where, yeah, it got everybody talking. It was MotoGP's magnum opus, so to speak. It was their Hollywood moment where they had something that transcended the sport because their this greatest rider had all of a sudden been caught up in a enormous controversy to try and win a title. His 10th title, yeah. The one he's been trying to get so hard.
Yeah, it's a championship that he'd been craving since 2009 when he won his last one. It was extraordinary the way that season. I mean, that's that season, the way it panned out, deserved a final round decider. And of course, that was the season that brought us two of the best races we've ever seen at Misano and Phillip Island that year. Phillip Island for me, 2015, is probably the one race in MotoGP that would rival Estoril 06. For just everything from start to finish. The headbutting a seagull. To the four-way fight up the front between Iannone, Rossi, Lorenzo, and Marquez. Marquez's stunning final lap to win it, beating Marc Marquez. Iannone doffing up Valentino Rossi on the final lap, which many people would argue that was the moment that cost Valentino the title, rather than Sepang, the moment where Iannone beat him to the podium in Phillip Island, which meant that Rossi had to race Marquez in Sepang rather than just follow him around and take the points. Of course, Rossi lost 3 points to Iannone that day. And really, the story of 2015, as it goes, is Rossi versus Marquez, which in many ways is a disservice to the guy and actually ended up winning the title in 2015. And it gets forgotten in amongst the controversy of Rossi and the batshit conspiracy theories of what Marc Marquez was up to. The Jorge Lorenzo really did produce a legendary ride to beat the Repsol Hondas that day to win the title.
Indeed. It's easy to forget that Lorenzo was so brilliant at the end of that season, winning 7 races and then, coming up strong at the end to really bring it home. And Lorenzo had to hold off a rampant Marquez. And, like, of course, conspiracy theories, because Marquez never made his usual case of lunging dive bomb. The response to that is he never had a chance to, because Valencia is a very slow circuit. It's very one line everywhere. And there wasn't really any golden chances for him to do it out there, because it's frigging hard to pass at Valencia, for Christ's sake.
And Lorenzo didn't give him a sniff.
No, Lorenzo did not give him a wheel. It was one of those things. It's easy to forget that we had a fantastic fight for that last win for Lorenzo, with Valentino Rossi basically in no man's land after making his way up to fourth place. And yeah, which way you slice it, it was incredibly impressive from Lorenzo, and it's a shame we often forget about that in the midst of conspiracy talk and Valentino Rossi missing out, basically.
Yeah, it was a shame that in many ways that season ended in acrimony because of what happened between Rossi and Marquez, and the fact that the three Spaniards up on the podium, or certainly two of the three Spaniards, because no one hit Dani Pedrosa, were getting booed up on the podium, even though Lorenzo had just produced an astonishing piece of skill and riding and nerve to hold off the Hondas. Because, of course, if both Marquez and Pedrosa had passed Lorenzo on that last lap, then Rossi would have won the title with fourth place. Because that would have been enough with Lorenzo outside of the top two. But as it was, Lorenzo clinched the title that year. Our number two on the list is also a championship decider from Valencia, which I guess would leave you thinking, which championship decider at Valencia could possibly rival the two MotoGP ones we've mentioned in 2006 and 2015? Well, we're heading to Moto3 for this one, and I was really, really tempted to put this at number one because I absolutely love this race. And I love this season. I mean, this is one of my favourite races of all time. And favourite seasons. The three-way winner-takes-all decider at Valencia in Moto3 in 2013. Where,
absolutely.
And to put this into perspective, Dre, this was how incredible this race was at the outset and how close the championship had become. Luis Salom, Maverick Viñales and Alex Rins, all three of them went to the final race at Valencia knowing that a win would win them the title. It was a literal winner-takes-all between the three of them.
Yeah, you will never see that again in Moto 3. The three guys, all pretty much on the same level, all beating the crap out of each other, all of them with a real chance, knowing that if they were, if they controlled their own destiny, that they won, they'd be champion. And an unbelievably tense finale going into the first real Moto 3 three-way title fight.
It was, and it kind of, in many ways, upstaged the MotoGP one later that day between Marquez and Lorenzo. I think more people were sort of focused on Moto3 because they were that excited for that race. Because these three Spanish kids had dominated all year. They'd won every race between them, with the exception of Alex Marquez, who won the race before that at Motegi. And that was really what set the stage for this, because it appeared, with a couple of races to go, that it was becoming a straight fight between Alex Rins and Luis Salom, who were the top two in the championship. But then both of them went on to crash out of the race at Motegi. Salom was taken out, ironically, by Maverick's cousin, Isaac Vinales. And then Alex Rins just crashed out on his own. Later on in that race, which meant that Maverick Vinales, from 22 points behind with two races to go, even though he was beaten to the wind by Marquez that day, suddenly catapulted himself right into the middle of the championship fight, which meant that the three of them were split by 5 points going into the final round. And unfortunately for Luis Salom, the late Luis Salom, he would crash out that leading group because, of course, that race in Valencia became a fight for the win between the three title contenders, because they were the three riders who were dominated all year. Salom would crash out, which left Usdre with a straight fight to the finish between Rins and Vinales for the World Championship. And Maverick Vinales, for context, only won two races all year prior to this. Because he'd so often been beaten on a final lap by Alex Rins. And many people were questioning Vinales and his temperament around that time, because he was being a bit flaky and he would often lose his nerve under pressure, and Rins would beat him. And I just go as far as to say, as that final lap where Maverick Vinales conquered his demons and beat Alex Rins to win the championship and the race that day, I go as far as to say that that one lap pretty much changed Maverick's career.
Yeah, I'd say so. We took him a lot more seriously then, and yeah, his temperament changed. Like he would go on to be a ridiculously good Moto2 rider. Yeah,
we were saying
well,
the kind of things then about Maverick that we still say about Fanati even now.
Exactly. We all questioned, you know, Maverick's bottle, his temperament, until that race, and a lot of the question marks came to an end after that one. He'd proven that, you know, in the most critical race of his career, he delivered, stepped up and won, and, you know, became world champion. And yeah, it's an easy one to forget, but now we realize, yeah, this guy's a bit special. But, you know, the talent had always been there. We just needed proof that, you know, he could really go out there and, you know, win the high pressure showdowns, and he did exactly that.
Yeah, he did, and this is why I had this as high as number two, because this one literally did go down to the final corner of a final lap where, as I mentioned, I mean, I was watching this at home and I was cheering Maverick on. I wanted Maverick to win this title so badly, and he was the guy that everyone was questioning. He was the guy that was almost being dismissed, because it was Salom and Rins, who I think Salom had won 7 races that year. Rins had won 6, and Maverick had only won the 2 going into this final round. But Maverick had been on the podium every single race, bar about, I think, 1 that year. He'd been so consistent. That was what kept him in the hunt. And, yeah, Rins goes past Maverick at the start of the final lap, and I was sort of thinking, oh, here we go. Rins does it again on the final lap and just does Maverick up. But yet Maverick would force his way through down at that tight hairpin out the back at turn 8. And as soon as he got through at that point, I was thinking, Maverick's got this. There's no real overtaking spot around the rest of this final lap. Maverick might have this. And Rins, as any rider would, goes for the dive bomb at the final corner to try and win the title. Gets up the inside of Maverick, but Maverick holds his nerve, ducks back underneath him on the exit of the corner, and out drags into the line to win the championship. And I just love the contrast of Maverick Vinales, who, as soon as he crosses the line, has that sort of mixture of bursting into tears, but also sort of bashing his head with his fingers to say, I did it, I held my nerve, I actually held my nerve under the pressure of it all. And Alex Rins, who's just been beaten to a world title, and to this day, still hasn't won a world title, of course, rides past Maverick Vinales and just sort of turns around him and applauds him, which I thought was brilliant, just a sort of measure of the man, a measure of Alex Rins, who was still only a teenager by that point and had just lost a world title, still had the presence of mind even then just to turn around and just applaud the man who'd beaten him to the world title. It was just a brilliant, brilliant spectacle between the three Spaniards. And yeah, it's of course tinged with sadness, because of course what's happened since, and of course we've lost Luis Salom since that point, and he never went on to win a world title. That was as close as he ever came. But just a brilliant, brilliant race. And as I say, it was so important to Maverick Vinales' career because he basically was a man transformed, pretty much a boy becoming a man that day, to win that Moto3 world title. It kind of begs the question, what on earth beats that to number one in our list? And those of you that only ever really follow MotoGP might not have seen this race. But if you haven't, we could not urge you strongly enough to go and watch this race after you finish listening to this, because we're heading back to 2011 and Brands Hatch for the British Superbike Championship decider, and Dre, it really came down to one lap, and to this day, the greatest lap of racing I have ever seen in any motor race.
Yeah, this was unbelievable. This was ridiculous. It was. There's no superlatives that fit in really to describe just how bonkers this race was, and just how two guys left everything, and I do mean everything, on the line to win the BSP title. And it was, and of course, if those guys that know this show well, we are of course talking about Brands Hatch 2011 and that fight between Tommy Hill and John Hopkins. And oh Lord. It's a bit special.
Yeah, they swap places, I think, at least five times on the final lap of the race. Where, for context, this was perhaps the greatest moment, the finest hour of the showdown. Of course, it was the showdown that created this scenario. Where, right, had this season gone to normal points, Shane Byrne would have won the title, and neither of these two would have been fighting for the title that day. Shaky would have won it up ahead of them. And it's... What amazes me even now about this race, it's that I've never seen a race like this where the TV director was flat out not even bothered to show the race winner crossing the line because there's something more important going on behind it. Because about 4 seconds back down the road, these two are fighting for the championship, heading to the line. So we, like, Shaky Byrne wins that race, but if you watch it on TV, you wouldn't have actually noticed him, because he was way up the road. But yeah, Tommy Hill and John Hopkins go into this final race, I think 2 points apart in the championship, with Tommy Hill ahead. Which basically meant that with the two battling for second place, whoever finished ahead would win the title. And in the end, Ray, they swap places 4 or 5 times across that final lap. And as you say, they're just leaving everything on the line, just throwing everything at it, knowing that this is it. This is the championship in this next 3 miles, and they're going to leave everything out there.
Yeah, pretty much. And we saw it. We saw just how far these guys are willing to go. Passing attempts you would never normally see. People looking for half a yard and an elbow out anywhere they could to try and come through on this situation, because they knew it was a winner-take-all showdown to basically win the championship. And, like, again, nobody cared about Shaky winning the race. No. Not a single soul. Sorry, Shaky. This wasn't about you, my friend. Mm. Yeah, it was an unbelievable race, an unbelievable final lap, and it all came down to the last corner and the fact that Tommy Hill had won the championship by 6 thousandths of a second over the line. You will never see anything like that again.
It is, and you... By the way, you can find that on YouTube. I've literally, just as I watch this, literally do a YouTube search, Hill Hopkins, and it's the first thing that comes up. So go and watch it. It is incredible.
You have no excuse.
Yeah, we'll post it on the Motorsport 101 Twitter account once the show goes up, so you can find it.
Yes.
It's a fantastic, fantastic race. And what almost gets forgotten in all this, Dre, is Tommy Hill almost blows it, like, right on the final 2 meters, because of course there are two lines at the end of the race. There's the finish line and there's another white line about 5 meters before it. Tommy Hill sits up as he goes over that line and very nearly blows it.
That's not the finish line, yeah. Tommy.
Tommy Hill sits up thinking the race is over and probably just glad it's over, because he's pretty much left everything out there. Just, he's poured his heart out over the last lap, and Hopkins then zooms up alongside him and very nearly beats him to the line. And poor John Hopkins, of course, he'd never win the British Superbike title, and he'd have injuries that would ravage his career ever since then. But yeah, Tommy Hill in the end, it would come down to clearways on the final lap, where Hopkins just goes for the Hail Mary, just sends it up the inside of Tommy Hill into the final corner. And Tommy Hill pretty much does what Maverick Vinales did to Alex Rins in that Valencia race, just ducks back underneath him and then out drags him to the line, until of course he sits up and nearly lets John Hopkins back in. But it is an extraordinary moment, just a brilliant, brilliant race. Still to this point, as I say, the best lap of racing I've ever seen in any form of motorsport. Just incredible racing between the two, and as Dre mentioned, the very fact that it was decided in the end by six thousandth of a second for the title in favour of Tommy Hill makes this the greatest title decider I think we've seen in motorcycle sport. It was an incredible finale. Before we go, we've got time to look ahead to this weekend. It's kind of neat that we're talking BSB because, of course, we have another decider this weekend. And Dre, I think we're probably clutching at straws if we're expecting anything to match 2011 and Brands Hatch between Hill and Hopkins. Yeah, I think, if much. Anything, I think we're doing well if he even makes it to race three, aren't we?
Yeah, I think so. I think Haslam has got one hand on this, and I think all Haslam really needs to do is just don't do anything crazy. Just race his race. And the fact he's got almost, he has got a race in hand here, he can win it. After race two, as long as he doesn't give up too many points to Shaky and to Brooks behind him, I think Haslam will be fine. Kawasaki's have gone well around here this year, and they may not necessarily have the ultimate pace to win, because I know Brooks is going to frigging go for it this weekend, because he's got pace around here in spades. We saw it in the regular season round earlier on, where it was him and Shaky that were gone basically. We've seen where Mossy has gone very well in the Indy layout as well, so. Yeah, it's a lot that's at stake here, obviously. I'm sure, and I know Haslam knows that, and I don't think he's going to approach it any differently. I think he's just going to take his time and see what he can do. And again, as long as he doesn't do anything too crazy, he should be fine.
Yeah, he's just got to hold his nerve, hasn't he, Leon Haslam? And he should have it. I mean, three podiums will be enough in theory. He can afford, even if Shaky and Josh Brooks are ahead of him. Haslam could afford to finish third in all three races, should I say, and still win the title. So as long as he doesn't do anything silly, this should be Haslam's title Brands in the BSB decider this weekend. But of course, it is a triple header, and rain could well affect things across the weekend. Race one will probably be taking place around the time you're listening to this, if you're listening to this at the point of release on Saturday afternoon. Races two and three on Sunday, where the title may well still be on the line. Of course, there is a championship potentially to be crowned and to be decided this weekend at Motegi as well, Drake. Of course, Joan Mir has his first shot at the Moto3 title, even though he has a sixth-place grid penalty hanging over his head from the last round.
Oh, no!
I wonder how much that's going to inconvenience him. Joan Mir, essentially, a podium or a top two finish is enough. And you kind of think that's well within Joan Mir's reach.
You think? He's been so good pretty much like the entire season. And I don't think he's had a round where he's dropped out of the top 10. He should be fine, and I don't think anything will happen that could easily just say, yeah, you know, like Mir will screw this up. But if he races his race, he doesn't get elbow barred, he doesn't have Fanati come over the top of him, he should be in the conversation, and he should be fine. Yeah. Even if not, I mean, what's the rush?
Yeah, I was going to say, part of me hopes he waits another week, because next week's episode 35 and John Mir's bike number is 36. Part of me wants John Mir to wait until the week after in Australia to clinch it, so we can talk about it on episode 36. And King will have a lot of fun making that thumbnail up. Two other classes, of course, at Motegi this weekend. Championship's not on the line just yet in Moto2 or MotoGP. But what's key this weekend, Dre, is that it's pretty much forecast to be wet all weekend at Motegi, which means that we could yet have another twist in the tail between Marc Marquez and Andrea Dovizioso.
We very well could.
Marquez binned it today in the wet.
Of course. That opens the door a little bit as well. But yeah, you're absolutely right.
Is this a must win for Ducati?
Yes, I think every round is a must win for Ducati from here on in, because Marquez is the guy right now. Like for all the talk about the way this unpredictable the season has been, Marquez has been on another level the last five or six rounds, and he's looking like the complete all round package right now. And again, fastest in FP1 in the wet. Again, a round where Ducati are meant to be quite strong around.
By a mile as well.
Yeah, and Marquez is in the conversation, wet or dry. So, again, it's going to come down to Ducati just getting whatever they can get out of this. But they have to start beating Marquez, like, now. Otherwise, like, the next two rounds You know, with Phillip Island, Marquez loves Phillip Island. He is super strong around there. And, you know, Sepang, another strong Honda around. Pedrosa goes very well around Sepang. That could be a problem. He could be a very nice spoiler for Marquez in this as well. So, yeah, the way it's going right now, like, they've got to start taking points out of Marquez and quickly. Because if he gets that one race buffer, it's going to be all that more damaging with only a handful of rounds to go.
It is. And we haven't even mentioned the third rider in this three-way championship fight, if it is still a three-way fight. But part of me worries, Dre, that Maverick Viñales and Yamaha's goose may well be cooked this weekend, because not only is Maverick not the same level of wet weather rider as Mark or Dovi, but that Yamaha just doesn't like the wet weather either.
No, it's not been good in wet conditions all year long. Only Valentino Rossi has had really any sort of influence on that this season, and that's only really because he's so frigging good at Assen, really, more than anything else. Petrucci had more than a chance of winning that one when that rolled around earlier this season. But yeah, Maverick in particular has struggled at wet races all season long. And again, like, Marquez and Dovi have gotten better at this as time has gone on, and they'll be thinking championship. And then Maverick is not going to pull the pin and be aggressive, because he hasn't got a choice here. Because he knows one more crash and he's pretty much done season-wise. So he's got to be very careful about this, to say the least. And yeah, like, I think Yamaha is struggling at the moment. They really are struggling in wet conditions, and Maverick's not been particularly strong out there. So yeah, I think this could be a damage limitation round for Maverick, and a round where damage limitation is no longer good enough.
No, it's whatever happens, it's likely to be a dramatic weekend out in Japan, and this weekend as the three flyaways get underway. And as I say, rain is forecast throughout at Motegi this weekend. Whatever happens, we will be back next week for episode 35. We're not going to devote it to Cal Crutchlow, don't worry. We're going to be back next week for episode 35 to talk all about MotoGP, Moto2 and Moto3. And in Japan, will we have a new Moto3 champion to talk about? We will have a new British Superbike champion to talk about next week. Question is, will it be Haslam, will it be Byrne, or will it be Brooks? As I say, join us next week for episode 35 to talk all about it. We also have episode 108 of Motorsport 101 to talk about next week, which falls in the middle of another dead week, I suppose, Dre, doesn't it, for Motorsport? Although, there is a brand new IndyCar calendar out, which I know has got many people talking based on one of the glaring omissions from the list.
Rest in peace, Watkins Glen, 2016 to 2017. we hardly knew ye. As yeah, IndyCars, they released their calendar for next year yesterday, and it's pretty much identical to last year's, except for, oh, there's no Watkins Glen at the penultimate round anymore. We're going back to Portland. We're going back to the kart days of 96. Fun times, yo. But that, and I think inevitably, I think we're going to make this the calendar special.
Oh, of course, basically. Yeah.
Yeah, we're gonna shout out to James Calendennis, who sent us the one of our strongest ever Ask Me questions about making our own custom calendar. I think that'll be the one where we're gonna beat our heads together and work that out, basically. So that's gonna be fun. We're gonna inevitably kill each other trying to decide like, how badly do we not want Monza on this calendar, basically.
Yeah, how badly are you gonna care for Imola?
Just a tad, just a little bit, you know. That's never going to happen, not in a million years.
Yeah, it's interesting, because I was listening to this week's show, if you haven't heard it, motorsport101.net to find it, where they talk about the potential of a Dutch Grand Prix and a street race in Amsterdam. And King's mentioning the fact that there are only really two circuits that could potentially host a Formula One Grand Prix. And he says, well, of course, there's a circuit at Assen. And I'm straight away, as I'm editing this, thinking, don't you dare touch Assen.
No. Assen is sacred.
Leave our motorcycle track.
You are not touching Assen. You touch acid and you fight me. No, never. Can't do that.
Yeah, so check out that out next week. Episode 108 of Motorsport 101. As I say, if you haven't listened to it already, episode 107 is available to listen to right now. Massive thanks to Andrew Harrison for joining me on this dead week of motorcycle racing, where we've still filled a near 2-hour show, because that's what we do around here.
Of course.
We'll be back next week. Episode 108 of Motorsport 101 and episode 35 of Bike Live is next week, where we look back on Motegi and Brands, the BSB decider. We'll see you next week. Bye for now.